Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. There's been a growing interest in progressive politics since Donald Trump was elected, and support for a new generation of politicians like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez may signal the arrival of a new left. What may be lost in reports of a new progressive movement is a decades-long history of the battles that were waged when Democrats often sounded more like Republicans on issues like welfare reform and incarceration. Attorney Michael Stephen Smith, the co-host of Law and Disorder Radio, has collected interviews and profiles of lawyers who continued working for justice for his new book called Lawyers for the Left in the Courts and the Streets and on the Air. It's published by OR Books, and I'm very pleased that it brings Michael Smith to our show now, along with Mara Vahaden Hilliard, co-founder and executive director of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, and Glenn Ford, executive editor of Black Agenda Report. Welcome, all of you, to our show.
Nice to be here.
Michael, you write
Thank you for having me.
Michael, you write that America is in a constitutional crisis?
Well, I think increasingly, and especially after 9/11, there's been a huge agglomeration of power in the hands of the executive branch, irrespective of the creature that holds office today. After 9/11, the Congress passed the Patriot Act, as you know, which is a horrible surveillance apparatus, and then the authorization to use military force, and then the National Defense Authorization Act. That act allows for the executive to both kidnap and hold, really forever, anybody, including American citizens. That was challenged by Chris Hedges and Noam Chomsky in federal court. They lost. And it also allows for, and we challenged it at the Center for Constitutional Rights with the Al-Awlaki case, it allows for the United States government to assassinate an American citizen. You can't get it any worse than that. So that's why I say what I did.
Your book collects profiles and interviews with lawyers, many of whom began their careers as progressives in the 1960s. Do you see a parallel between that era and today?
Yes. The book profiles 23 different lawyers. Lawyers my age, I'm in my mid-70s, and then lawyers my parents' age, who would be in their hundreds now, but they're not here. And the parallel, I think, is the fight, increasingly difficult, to keep the rule of law and the democratic rights.
But the reason I ask is because some wrote of a new left in the 1960s. Do you see a new left emerging today as well?
Well, I'd like Glenn to come in on this, but yes, I do.
Well, we're going to ask Mara and Glenn to join in just a moment.
Socialism is no longer a dirty word. Half the people in the country actually prefer it to capitalism, according to the latest polls.
Although Republicans are using it as a dirty word and something to hit the Democrats over the head with.
The more they do that, the greater I welcome it, because it gives us a chance to talk about what we mean by socialism.
From the 1950s into the 70s, the country was divided over civil rights in Vietnam. Were we in a constitutional crisis then as well?
Well, the war in Vietnam was fought without a declaration of war by Congress, which so it was fought illegally. Civil rights struggle is still going on. Half the people in this country are poor or near poor, particularly minorities, particularly African Americans. So yes, indeed, the fight is still going on.
So let's bring Mara and Glenn into this. Begin with you, Mara. Do you agree that we're now in a legal or constitutional crisis of some kind?
Well, I think what we've seen in the United States, when you look at history and progressive history is there are always ebbs and flows, and there are points in time where you look at what's happening around us, and, you know, I would imagine the people who are struggling then would think, wow, this seems almost impossible that we can overcome what we're faced with, and yet people always forge forward and always make change. So the long trajectory is always towards progressive social change, towards progress. But at any period of time, you also have that pushback, that return back, those very difficult struggles where it feels like it's, you know, moving the stone up the mountain. And I think there are times when it can feel like that, but it also very much relates to how people in the United States themselves are feeling about the capacity for social change and about what it means to be in the streets and to demand change and to feel like they can affect change. And I think that's the other sort of unspoken struggle is what happens in terms of the propaganda that comes from the U.S. government and from other politicians to sort of endlessly try and tell people that they actually can't be the change makers, that they need to sit back, that they need to be spectators, that they need to rely only on the ballot box as their only hope, when in reality the changes that we have didn't occur that way. They occurred because people demanded them, because there was near revolution in the streets, and because the outcome was foretold by the people's demands.
Glenn, are progressives now facing battles that they thought they'd already won?
Oh, I don't know. I don't think most of us felt that we'd won nearly enough battles. In terms of a constitutional crisis, I think it's inarguable from a left perspective that the system, late-stage capitalism, is in crisis, and it's manifested by the overseers of that system now trying to operate in ways that go beyond the law, which they periodically do when they have crises. Our crises, as folks at the bottom struggling, is to get a movement together that copes with the machinations of the upper classes as they deal with their crisis, and to advance the interests of the people. I think this book, Michael's book, is quite educational and instructive, because it shows by its selection of lawyers that this crop of wonderful lawyers basically comes from an era when we did respond to the crisis of capitalism, the Vietnam era and post-Vietnam era, the Black Liberation Movement era, with a cadre of lawyers who challenged not just the policies of the powers that be, but the authority of the capitalist state to impose its authority.
Michael, one of the lawyers you quote in the book, Jim Lafferty, said in a Law and Disorder interview that things are much worse today than they were in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. And he said that in 2007, 12 years ago. Are things even worse now in 2019?
Well, I think so. You had 6 years ago the Citizens United decision. John Roberts, the guy who said he was only going to call balls and strikes, Roberts writing that corporations are people and that they can give as much money as they want to whatever political entity they want to give it to. I'll believe that a corporation is a person the day it gets a colonoscopy.
So are, with that decision, are rights being extended to corporations even as they're being whittled away from average Americans?
Yes. The corporate powers that be have extraordinary influence on this government. Jimmy Carter, who should know, said we're no longer living in a democracy, we're living in an oligarchy. That is a rule by a handful. You know, I think that in terms of justice, there's no such thing in or out of the courts. H. Rapp Brown said, justice means just us. And I think that's increasingly evident in the way that the federal courts
are operating, particularly with the Federalist Society stacking the courts with these ultra-right wingers. They've got control of the Supreme Court, and they're appointing for life judges in the appellate courts. So we're stuck with these people for the next generation. And their underlying theme is that the executive can do whatever it wants.
So if we have a growing corporate power, is that to some degree because the unions have organized labor has pretty much been losing its power?
I think so. What do you think so, Glenn?
Well, you know, we talk about the Federalist Society, and usually the discourse about them is that they want to revert to original intent, what the founders actually wanted. But that's a lie. It's actually 180 degrees different. They are desperately trying to refashion the law through interpretation so that it fits the needs of 21st century monopoly capitalism. And that is where we get corporations as people.
You know, you can't say that you know what was in the mind of somebody 200 years ago. That's an utter fiction. They use it, but they decide cases on what they've already decided, and then they bring in that fiction.
Well, we know what was in the minds of the founding fathers when they created the Electoral College. It was to protect the slave states, and yet that's never invoked these days.
That's true. The founding fathers were not Democrats in the way that you and I would appreciate the term. They were for rule of the rich. They openly said that, but they couldn't quite go all the way because they needed a steam valve. And when they passed the Constitution, they couldn't get it through because it didn't have a Bill of Rights. That was a big fight to get the First Amendment for freedom of speech and freedom of assembly, to get the Fourth Amendment for the right of privacy, the Fifth Amendment, due process, fairness, the Sixth Amendment, the right to have an attorney, the right to be free from cruel and unusual punishment. That was a fight to get that. But that being said, the founding fathers appreciated a certain measure of democracy. These were educated people. Thomas Jefferson, John Adams knew their history. They knew the history of Greece. They knew what happened in Athens in the 6th century BC with Athenian democracy and how it ended up on the rocks because of militarism. They knew the history of the Roman Empire and how Caesar crossed the Rubicon. You know what the origin of that term is? The Rubicon's a river outside of Rome. And they brought the troops back across the river into Rome. And that was the end of democracy in that era. They knew that, and they tried to establish a system of checks and balances. And that's been destroyed. The last thing I want to say is that you can see that just from what happened a couple of weeks ago with Trump allocating $5 billion he can take out of the military to build his wall.
Mara, if companies... But, you know, yeah, go ahead, Mara.
I just want to jump in because even when we talk about that, the system of checks and balances or the so-called founding fathers, I mean, what they were founding, what they were creating, their system of checks and balances, it was a slave-owning, slave-using country. It was enslaving people for their wealth, for them to succeed, to build the country that exists today. And so at every step, while they may have been well-read and intellectuals and admiring whoever they were admiring, they were making sure that they were enshrining their own power over that of enslaved populations, of indigenous populations, over women, over people who are not landowners. And, you know, that's where I think at any point in time when we look at the history of the United States and we look at it as if it's... you know, either set in stone and that we have to return to something and, you know, the idea of the original intent that you were talking about, or do we look at, you know, the history of the United States, both its, you know, progressive history and its awful history, and see it as a constantly flowing river, as an always moving challenge? I mean, this is where, you know, going back to the quote from Jim Lafferty, you know, where I might take issue with Jim, and I say this with Jim being one of my very dear friends, but I don't look at the periods of, you know, 1950, 1960, 1970 and say that what we're in now is worse than what we were in then. I think that you have to look at different elements of that. I mean, if you think about the 1950s, we're talking about the McCarthy era, the Red Scare, people losing their jobs, being in prison, terrified because of their political beliefs. We're talking about Jim Crow apartheid in the United States and people struggling and losing their lives and being firebombed and hosed and beaten because they were standing up against that at a time when it must have felt impossible to think that Jim Crow laws could be overturned and that that could change, and yet it changed. I think the difference that we feel now is there was also this feeling of optimism into the 60s and the early 70s and this hope that the civil rights movement, that the black liberation movement, that the women's liberation movement, that the anti-war movement, that the LGBT movement.
The Great Society, the war into poverty.
Yeah, that was going to win, that was what was going to change, that was the future, that revolution, in a way, was almost here. And so then we do see this deepening of enshrining of corporate powers really as a counterbalance to the people power that was changing, has changed, and will still change the United States. I mean, when you're talking about the rights of corporations, we're seeing a formality, really, of the merger of legal structures of the state with the legal needs of corporations. I mean, we're seeing it now with these anti-protest laws that are being enacted all over the United States, and these laws focused on what they call critical infrastructure. It's really to protect the fossil fuels industry against protests. And over again, these legislators who are paid by these industries, they're enacting laws to protect corporations, to make the police really the private security of corporations. So, yes, we're always going to have this battle. But
how does that affect the work of progressive lawyers?
Well, that's the thing about Michael's book that I love, and I'm incredibly honored to be included among so many of these people who are my heroes. But Michael's book is ultimately a very optimistic book because you're looking at people who are fighting against the power, fighting against the waves of repression at any given time, and winning because of their persistence.
Glenn, you wanted to add something?
Well, I was going to agree with Mara. Certainly, the founding fathers of the United States were familiar with Athenian democracy. Athens was, of course, a slave state, and the founding fathers were establishing a slave state. But it was also the first bourgeois democracy, a state that was invented out of almost whole cloth with the intention of furthering the pursuit of money by that founding class. And everything about the structure that they created was to give all of the advantages to money and to, in fact, give that class the ability through things like the Electoral College to shape the further contours of that state. We still have the rule of money. Not too much has really changed in that kind of essence.
You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI, New York 99.5 FM. Michael, Shakespeare joked in Henry VI, Part 2, the first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers. And lawyers have been the butt of jokes for ages. Is the role of lawyers, some of them at least, misunderstood?
No, I think that the role of most lawyers is totally understood. People understand that they protect the status quo. They protect the rich against everybody else. And people don't like them. Lawyers are the second most unpopular group in the country next to politicians. And most of them are lawyers.
Except that when we have a problem and somebody says, you better get a lawyer.
Well, that's true. And people appreciate it when a lawyer's there fighting for them.
But aren't defense lawyers in general often portrayed as being left-leaning?
I think so, because by the nature of their practice, they're up against the state power. But lawyers have been unpopular for centuries. Thomas More left lawyers out of his utopia. Dick the Butcher, when he said, let's kill all the lawyers, I think that had a resonance with people. But I wanted to add...
But Shakespeare's line was uttered by a character who's plotting treachery. So some scholars argue that Shakespeare was actually praising lawyers who work for justice.
that could be. Len, what do you think? Glenn, what do you think about that?
Well, you know, we have lawyers and we have lawyers. My daughter is a corporate lawyer, so I won't say her name so that her name won't be associated with mine and it Whoa. Might endanger her job. But even those lawyers that lots of folks esteem because their names are on good laws, we have to remember the conflicts that existed between radical lawyers like those that you cover in the book and their predecessors in the 1930s who differed on what the nature of radical lawyering is. And I think the best example was the conflict between the National Negro Congress, which was central in publicizing the huge political trial of the Scottsboro Boys during the 1930s. And they tussled with the emerging legal apparatus of the NAACP. And they had a fundamental kind of disagreement about what a political trial should be. The National Negro Congress, which was led by communists, wanted to expose the actual nature of not just the Southern Jim Crow society, but the larger new U.S. capitalist society through this trial, while the NAACP wanted to keep the issue confined to issues of innocence and guilt. And we see the same kind of conflicts between progressive and radical lawyers today. I wish there was more conflict. I wish there were more progressive and radical lawyers today to have a bigger fight about this.
But Michael, don't you have an ongoing program called Lawyers You'll Like?
Well, I have a program called Law and Disorder on BAI. Mm-hmm. We've been broadcasting for 15 years. We started off on this station 15 years ago. We were every other week, and then we were every week. And then
right now, it sounds like we need you every day.
well, we had initially myself, Michael Ratner, who was the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, Dalia Hashad, a Muslim American woman from Egypt, and Heidi Boghossian, who was the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild. Dalia moved. Michael passed away 3 years ago. At that time, we had 60 stations, thanks to BAI launching us, and today we have 120. And our notion is, and I'm going to share a one-sentence quote with you from William Kunstler, who was Martin Luther King's lawyer. And Kunstler said, "The law is in its fundamental essence nothing more than a method of control created by a socioeconomic system determined at all costs to perpetuate itself by all means necessary for as long as possible." Well, I quoted that to Michael Tiger, who we interview in the book, and Michael said, "Well, he's half right." And if you bat 500, it ain't bad. Mm-hmm. But there's another aspect to it, and that's that they can't just control everybody by having six cops in every street corner. So they've got to make promises to you. You know, everybody's created equal. You've got the right to speak out and gather and so on. And that contradiction is what the lawyers in my book, Lawyers for the Left, exploit. That contradiction between the promises they make and the purpose of law generally to keep the status quo.
Well, that brings us to Mara again, because Mara, haven't you represented many protesters?
I have. I have represented protesters all across the United States in many different actions, including mass arrests, brutality, as well as in the context of domestic spying operations on peaceful political movements in the United States. And, you know, and there too, you know, it's one of these situations where we can see every time the social justice movement is manifesting in the streets, there is always a concomitant response from the state, from police agencies, as well as federal law enforcement, of repression against those movements. And that's the time when, you know, we've brought these lawsuits, class action lawsuits, representing in Washington alone more than 1,000 people who were subject to mass arrest, to brutality. And the outcome of those lawsuits was very significant in terms of not just getting damages for the people that were arrested. The District of Columbia had to pay out more than $25 million over a series of our lawsuits, but also changing the laws of the District of Columbia in terms of how police officers engage and respond to demonstrations and training those officers. And, you know, we could see those changes in the streets.
But wait, can I interrupt for just a second? Isn't protest protected by the Constitution, the right to protest?
Well, protest is, of course, always protected by the Constitution, but that doesn't mean that the police agencies don't act against protests illegally. And so when we bring lawsuits, we're vindicating the right to protest. But what we're doing and the way we look at our lawsuits is not just simply to say, well, there's been this abstract violation of the First Amendment and we just want an announcement that they violated First Amendment rights, because that won't change anything. What we have to change and what we've done in here and elsewhere is to actually look and take apart piece by piece, what is it that the police did? How were they, what were the techniques that they used against demonstrators, and how do we disarm them of those actions, those techniques, those mechanisms? How do we get those banned in the particular?
Do you see any parallels between the do you see any parallels between the treatment of political protesters and the treatment of undocumented people from Latin America at the border with Mexico?
I think there are parallels but the parallels really relate back to when police agencies, and that would include, you know, CPB or anyone else, are making decisions about other people's lives and treating people as if they're subhuman. And there's this demonization that we always see, the demonization of protesters, the demonization of undocumented people in the United States, or immigrants or refugees seeking to enter the United States. And by demonizing, it gives license to law enforcement agencies to act against groups illegally and often with great cruelty. And we see the same thing, too, when it comes to oppressed communities, the extreme demonization of poor working class or communities of color in the United States, so that when we see the police acting against them, the idea is that the hope with these kind of demonization efforts is that Americans will turn away.
Didn't you go to Hampshire College, the progressive school in Massachusetts that's facing difficulty now? What are the problems there?
I did go to Hampshire College. I went to Hampshire College and I attended Columbia Law School. I don't know all of the details of what's happening in Hampshire, but I certainly stand with all of the Hampshire students and Hampshire alum who believe very strongly that what Hampshire offers and what is significant about Hampshire is its independent nature and the fact that it is a school where students are expected and required to think for themselves and to create a course of study that is meaningful and that leaves them with a path forward, as opposed to just, you know, regurgitating, a common curriculum. And that's what's really significant about that school. So I think there are many of us who are really hoping to see an outcome that leaves that institution standing and strong as an independent body.
Well, you know, Mara, I think you're a wonderful example of the kind of student that that college tried to graduate, because you went to law school in order to do what you love doing, and that's litigating the kind of cases that you've talked about. And you just went out and set up your own law practice right out of law school. You organized a partnership for civil justice, and you did the kind of things that we so much need in this country. So I wish Hampshire College can stay on its feet and produce more people like you.
And Glenn, several people in Michael's book stress the importance of political activity or resistance in the street or coming from below. Well, right here in a largely democratic New York City, don't protesters need permits?
Well, yes, there are chains on protest all over the country. And of course, Verhaden Hilliard can testify to that. You know, I feel better on your side of the mic, and I'd like to ask our comrade lawyers about the aftermath of what I think is the first emergence of a mass, or a promise of a mass black movement in two generations, and that is Black Lives Matter emerging after the police killing of Mike Brown in Ferguson.
Well, why do you think it's become so vilified in some circles? What, do people see Black Lives Matter as a real threat?
Well, the FBI certainly does. They label these...
The FBI, which Donald Trump says is run by Democrats?
The FBI labeled Black Lives Matter as...
Black identity extremists.
Black identity extremists, and they're spying on him, and they'd like to bust him up the same way they did with COINTELPRO in the 60s. And I just wanted to add something to what you said, Glenn, when you said you feel more comfortable on the other side of the mic. You've got a wonderful program. Black Agenda Report has also a radio show, and that puts you on the other side of the mic, and I'd like to give a plug for that.
We are back with Michael Stephen Smith, the co-host of Law and Disorder Radio, and author of a new book from OR Books called Lawyers for the Left, in the Courts, in the Streets, and on the Air. Also, an attorney, Mara Verheyden Hilliard, co-founder and executive director of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, and Glenn Ford, who's the executive editor of Black Agenda Report, which is also a podcast. Is it broadcast anywhere, Glenn?
Black Agenda Radio is broadcast over the Progressive Radio Network, and therefore over a number, I don't know how many, of radio stations out there. And of course, we post the results every Monday on Black Agenda Report site.
Didn't you criticize the Obama administration and some African Americans who supported Barack Obama?
I think that we were the premier black critic
and why?
Of because the Obama administration.
Did he distance himself from progressives?
Obama was never a progressive. You know, my first encounter with Barack Obama was in 2003. At that time, I was going every week. I would patrol to see which new black recruits had been enlisted for the Democratic Leadership Council, which is the corporate wing of the Democratic Party, founded by Bill Clinton and Al Gore. And I came across Barack Obama's name, that he was a new Democrat in 2003. He was at that time a state senator in Chicago running for the U.S. Senate. And we put him through a whole week of interrogation in which he responded to us both on the phone and in writing. It would take a while to explain what transpired during that month. But it was quite clear at the end of that examination of the 2003 Barack Obama, even after his much-vaunted peace speech on Iraq, that he was no progressive.
So can some of the issues that are now concerning Democrats, can they be traced back to policies embraced by Democrats like Jimmy Carter, Clinton's, Barack Obama?
Yes, Clinton and Barack Obama.
Clinton signed the welfare reform bill.
Of course. Look, Barack Obama is Clinton. That's why he became early on a new Democrat. You must become a new Democrat, whatever they call it now, before you can become eligible for massive corporate funding. It is corporate funding that structures the Democratic Party and who wields power in it, who is primaried and who is not.
Now, the fights over issues like President Trump's border wall have received a lot of attention, but are any of you particularly concerned about some of the issues that are flying under the media radar? Glenn, Black Agenda Radio recently aired an interview on efforts to end a 10-2 law in Louisiana. What's a 10-2 law and how is it a problem?
A 10-2 law is one of those things that folks like to call a vestige of Jim Crow. Well, it's a hell of a vestige. Under the 10-2 Louisiana law, which is all but unique in the nation, you can be convicted of a criminal offense by a 10-2 vote of a jury.
Not a unanimous jury.
And although lower court has overturned that law. There are still 2,000 people languishing behind bars in Louisiana because they were convicted under that law. The Supreme Court has agreed, they agreed last week, to look into that. But of course—
That doesn't mean that you'll be happy with the decision.
Well, we know we won't be happy with the decision if people don't stay in the streets. The reason that the Supreme Court is looking at it is people have been in the streets.
Now, Mara, what hurdles do lawyers starting out nowadays face if they want to work on justice or rights issue? Hasn't law school gotten far more expensive while the job market for lawyers has tightened up?
Law school is expensive, and law school has been expensive, certainly when I was there. And I think one of the things that happens is a lot of young people go into law school thinking that they want to do public interest work, and a lot of law schools recruit, sort of offering themselves as if they have public interest programs. But once you're in law school, you're automatically placed sort of on a moving sidewalk that takes you into corporate law. And in order to do public interest law, you actively have to work against it. It's sort of this mythology that getting the corporate law job is, you know, the brass ring and harder to do. But actually, it's much harder to struggle to go into public interest work and also make a decision about how you want to live your life. I mean, if you're being dangled the idea of, you know, bank accounts and a different type of lifestyle, you know, people have to decide what really matters to them and how they want to live.
Abraham, go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say Abraham Lincoln didn't go to law school, neither did Clarence Darrow. Now 3 years of law school is mandatory. And then adding to that, Thurgood Marshall got his law degree at Howard. Now the only Supreme Court justice who didn't get a law degree at Harvard or Yale is Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
And that's the other aspect of this. So you know, then you go into law school because if you want to do social justice, civil rights work, and meanwhile, you're piling on debt. But the fact is, it used to be that people got law degrees because they went to college and then they added on an additional year. And so for a long time, you know, the oldest partners in the law firms had those law degrees, not JDs. And then they made 3 years of law school mandatory almost everywhere. There are a handful of states that still allow people to read for the law. The reality is law school is a very money-making business for universities. And in many respects, I think that law school is 2 years too long, that if people went into law school and had a year of solid, you know, classroom training and then were doing experiential training and learning how to be real lawyers and then ultimately, you know, going through whatever process to be certified as a lawyer, we'd have a lot more real lawyers. There's a lot of lawyers who graduate from law school and they've never heard or seen, you know, what a deposition is or interrogatories or the most basic elements of trial practice. And that's really a common feature. But part of this, too, I believe, is a result of the GI Bill, that when you had this shift in America where more and more people, where people of color, where lower income people, where women also were starting to enter into all of these academic institutions, there was a desire to create greater and greater gatekeeping. And you can see that with the prohibitive costs of law school. And then, of course, when people get out, they're indentured. They owe so much debt.
Glenn, you wanted to add to that.
Yeah, I'm the non-lawyer here on the panel.
Who put a daughter through law school.
But I want to draw a parallel here. Journalists used to not have to go to J school. In fact, journalism historically has been a function of advocacy. That is, until relatively recently, basically the 20th century, most newspapers were advocacy journals. They represented a political point of view, not necessarily a party, but a political tendency. And folks knew that when they went shopping for their literature. But with the corporate newspaper, one that is, in fact, invented for the purpose of creating a corporate consensus, narrowing the arena of discourse. We also had, funded lavishly by the corporate class, the invention of these journalism schools, great halls of misinformation that decided what the parameters of journalism would be. And of course, the folks who were advocates for the non-moneyed classes were forced to the peripheries, places like WBAI.
I wanted to comment on women in law. The great African-American feminist attorney, Florence Kennedy, tried to get into Columbia Law School in 1949. They wouldn't let her in. So she threatened to sue him. She said, "You didn't let me in because I'm black." And they said, "No, we didn't let you in because you're a woman." But they yielded. She got in. And they didn't even have a bathroom for her to use. That was the situation all throughout the 50s. When I got to NYU Law School in 1964, they used to brag that 10% of the class were women. That was the highest in the country. And now that's all changed. Now, I don't know what it was at Columbia in 1994 when Mara was there, but now about half the class are women. So they're now allowing women in, and that was a big gain. And six of the people that I feature in Lawyers for the Left are women. And they've made some tremendous contributions to the extension of democracy in this country.
Now, changing the subject a bit, my apologies for sounding a little MSNBC or CNN here. What do each of you think about the various candidates lining up for the Democratic candidacy? Glenn, a segment on Black Agenda Radio in January referred to Kamala the jailer and her corporate backers, and I'm guessing you're not a fan of Kamala Harris.
We call her Kopmala. She is a career prosecutor. She is not a crusading prosecutor, as Krasner in Philadelphia was purported to be. She is your standard upwardly mobile black person looking to have more black faces in high places, including places of persecution like prosecutors. And I think that that is how she should be seen and opposed in the primaries.
Now, Joe Biden is now apologizing for the way Anita Hill was treated during the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings, but he hasn't apologized for how he, as the Judiciary Committee chairman, conducted that interrogation. Does the fact that he's felt the need to address the matter reflect a change in the Democratic Party?
Well, I think they're scared to death of Bernie Sanders. I mean, for one thing, if the programs that he's advocating are enacted, it's going to cost the corporate class a lot of money, and they know that. So what they're doing is they're putting up people to try to undercut him. Harris is one example. Cory Booker, the senator from Big Pharma, is another example. They're throwing as much as they can at Sanders to try to prevent him from getting the nomination. He should have got it the last time, but Clinton cheated him out of it, and the Democratic apparatus cheated him out of it. And they're afraid that he's going to get it this time, and I think that's what motivates these various candidates.
Although Joe Biden right now is the leading candidate. Is the left more divided than the right, or the center simply by virtue of raw diversity?
What do you think, Glenn? It
depends on what you call the left. There is a phony left, and there is a real left. The real left is very small. And then there is this emerging democratic socialist variety, which is rather amorphous. I find it fascinating. And, of course, in the course of time, in the course of struggle, we'll see it congeal and take on a firmer shape. But the Democratic Party is in crisis. And Bernie Sanders represents that crisis because Bernie Sanders is championing super majority issues. 80% of Democrats or 85% of Democrats support Medicare for all, but Nancy Pelosi is against it and actively working to undermine it. 85 or 90% support the concept of a Green New Deal, but Nancy Pelosi is actively trying to sideline that.
Any number of Democrats voted present when that came up. They didn't vote against it, obviously, but they also didn't vote for it.
Well, this is Democratic leadership, which is beholden to the corporations actually undermining issues that are at the heart of the Democratic base's aspirations. That's the nature of the crisis, and Bernie Sanders' candidacy brings this to a head.
Mara?
I just want to say, I mean, to Glenn's point and his earlier point, earlier this week in Washington, D.C., Barack Obama came at the invitation of Nancy Pelosi to speak to a closed-door meeting of new members of Congress to basically talk them away from single-payer health care or the idea of the Green New Deal, with a speech about how they had to explain how they were going to pay for it. And how you can't, it's wonderful to have big ideas, but, you know, this just costs too much. This is the richest country in the world. This country can actually afford it. It's an issue of allocation of resources. But I don't recall Barack Obama feeling he had to explain how he was going to pay for the bombs dropping on Libya, you know, or any other military intervention. I mean, that is the massive amount of the American budget. And every 4 years, you know, the American people are being told that they just have these two choices between the Democrats and the Republicans. Two parties that neither of which are going to veer away from the war machine in the United States and ultimately not really break from this corporate control of our society. And you can see that people are turning out and tuning out. I mean, they don't want to vote. A lot of people are simply not voting. If the U.S. introduced, for example, ranked choice voting or proportional voting, which are truly democratic means of holding elections, you would see a lot more people voting, but you would also see a lot more ideas and issues being presented. And this is the issue, is that once again we're now being presented with a slate of Democratic candidates, and they're being offered up as, you know, the single hope to get rid of Trump, of course, and, you know, Trump, who is, you know, racist, misogynist monster, and there's no dispute about that. But remember, when he was elected, we immediately saw millions of people in the streets, people, many of whom had never participated in political protests before. And all of them were coming out. They were marching against Trump. He issued the Muslim ban. People were filling the airports. And very, very quickly, we started being told as a people that we should become spectators, that we should go back inside, and that we should now all look for an investigation into Trump based on Russia, not based on his outrageous, offensive, racist, anti-women policies, but on Russia. And everything became turned towards Russia. And everyone was told that they should wait for Mueller. And Mueller, suddenly among the left, among liberals, Mueller became this savior figure, where traditionally the progressives and the left in the United States did not look at the FBI, based on its true history, as being, you know, the providers of justice. So we've had this extremely disorienting period. And now, for example, the Washington Post and others are writing articles saying, oh, the Democrats are now free to address important issues because the Mueller report has come out and there's no collusion and we can move on. Instead of really talking about what happened for the last 2 years, where people were being redirected from fighting for the things that they believe in to just endlessly enter into this new period of Russia-phobia. And I think that's been extremely dangerous. There were only a handful of journalists who were willing to fight this, people like Max Blumenthal, Aaron Maté, Brian Becker, and, you know, a number of others. But they were the ones who were speaking out. And now, you know, we see the situation where we're again being told all focus must be on the upcoming presidential elections, and we're not being offered the real choices for change and the opportunities for change, which again means that the answers aren't going to come fully from the ballot box, that what has to happen is it has to come from the people standing up and fighting and not looking to some abstract elected official to be their leader.
Glenn or Michael, either one. Michael, you first and then Glenn.
Well, with your permission, I'd like to read 8 lines from my book, which
okay. You're here because of the book, so
sums up
go ahead.
My position. This is how I end the introduction to lawyers for the left. But for me and many radical lawyers, there's another crucial step. Capitalism ultimately, increasingly, is not compatible with democracy and the rule of law.
Marx studied law. Castro and Lenin were lawyers. For them and for me, there's one way out of the impending catastrophe, the ongoing ecocide, the heightened threat of nuclear annihilation, the crushing of democracy. And that is the building of a mass movement that will take political power to replace our current system with a genuine economic and political democracy. Imagine living in a socialist USA.
But, Michael, there are a number of progressive legal organizations like the Center for Constitutional Rights, the National Lawyers Guild, the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, the ACLU. They're not doing their job?
Well, they're not trying to build a new people's party. They're trying to defend and extend democracy. They're doing their job wonderfully. But what I'm talking about and what I'm hoping that will develop out of the current storm that we see going on is that people will realize that if they don't take it into their own hands and free themselves, they're not going to be free.
Glenn?
Black Agenda Report was the only black site that was listed in the Prop or Not Black List published by the Washington Post in late November of 2016 in what was the opening salvo of Russiagate post 11. That is when it was on, and we saw this new McCarthyism emerging. Russiagate is not just about the fact that Hillary Clinton lost and the Democratic Party wants someone like her back and in the helm. Russiagate is much larger than that. It's about the national security state and the military-industrial complex being intent on keeping up, maintaining the momentum of the Obama military offensive of 2011 when they went into Libya and then Syria and at the same time reset to near permanent war relations with Russia and pivoted to China. All of that militarism momentum has to be sustained by having an other who is a demonic and ubiquitous kind of enemy. That's Russiagate.
Now, Trump and other Republicans have been bringing up the threat of socialism. I don't know what kind of traction that rhetoric is having, but I'm wondering whether conservatives and, to some degree, members of the Democratic Party are again trying to criminalize the advocacy of ideas. You have a chapter in the book criminalizing the Communist Party.
Yes. Well, that's precisely what they're trying to do. They falsely accused the Communist Party when they destroyed it. It was the government that destroyed the Communist Party of advocating the overthrow of the government by force and violence, which was a huge lie.
Isn't the Smith Act still in effect?
The Smith Act is still in effect, yes.
That was part of that, the Alien and Registration Act.
Yes, that was the act named after Howard K. Smith, a Southern segregationist. He got that act passed, and that's what they used to destroy the Communist Party, and it's still on the books.
So you're not saying we're going through the same kind of thing now. And there are arguments against the Soviet Union. It wasn't an ideal government.
No, I write about that. I don't defend the kind of political system in the Soviet Union. But what I'm talking about is a genuine democratic socialist economy where people control the economy, not just political but economic democracy. And that, I think, is either we get there or we're in a lot of trouble because with the threat of nuclear annihilation, the threat of global warming, we're not being defended against that by this government. We have to take things into our own hands.
We've pretty much run out of time. My great thanks to the three of you for such an interesting conversation. We've been speaking with Michael Stephen Smith. His book is called Lawyers for the Left. It's from OR Books. Also, Mariva Hayden Hilliard and Glenn Ford. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you,
Leonard. Thank you very much.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to Michael Smith, Mariva Hayden Hilliard, and Glenn Ford, to Hugh Sansom, who produced today's segment, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, to Reggie Johnson, who is at the audio controls, and to my executive producer, Jesse Lent. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.